I would like to thank Dean Jones for the invitation to have a part in this second centennial convocation, and to thank him personally for the opportunity he has allowed us as members of the Society for the Study of Black Religion to participate in this great event.
It's really the fifth chapter of the forthcoming book on the social teaching of the black churches. And I do this with some hesitation because I've got to presuppose that you are familiar with the four chapters that precede it. And I do not want to summarize those four chapters because I could not find an easy and brief way of doing that. But in this chapter... Okay, no, I don't have the chapter headings right. They are each in two parts, and I should have done that. They should have brought that along. This chapter focuses on power and the understandings of power in the black church. And the first section is going to be on in setting the situation is going to be on independence as a condition for freedom. And then the second section will be on understandings of power in the black church. And then the third section is on the relationship between the black church's understanding of power and black power, in order to show that tension and conflict. The bottom line of all of my work is this. I'll just give you the bottom line. The fundamental presupposition is that humans by nature resist oppression, and blacks are no exception. Blacks discovered a religious justification for their resistance in discovering the principle, the biblical principle, of the parenthood of God and the kinship of all people, formerly called in the 19th century the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man. This religiously justified principle later became embodied in the black churches. So those three presuppositions are very fundamental. Humans by nature resist oppression. That blacks found a religious justification for their resistance in this biblical principle, which became for them a fundamental hermeneutic. And that this religiously justified principle became embodied in the black churches. In his 1946 address before the extra session of the African Methodist Episcopal Church Conference, Bishop Ransom depicted a parallel development between the history of the black churches and that of the nation itself. The significance of his insight cannot be overly emphasized because it virtually linked the institutionalization of racial separation with the beginnings of the Republic itself. Hear what he says. The second thing I want to say is that we appreciate our relationship to our nation's formation and growth. I mean the parallel history of the African Methodist Episcopal Church and the United States of America. In 1787, when the Constitution was being framed in Philadelphia, we were five or six blocks away on 6th and Lombard, organizing the African Methodist Episcopal Church. As the first lines of the bill proclaiming independence from the United Colonies from Great Britain were struck off, we too floated our flag six blocks away for manhood and independence to the establishment of a church to the glory of God. Now, a similar statement could have been made by Black Baptists as well, since their first pioneer churches were founded in Georgia and South Carolina a few years prior to the Constitutional Convention. Similarly, less than a decade later, as you all know, the African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church in New York City had taken its first stride towards independence. Collectively, these groups symbolize the universal thrust of blacks for racial separation in order to effect self-expression. Now, I contend that some measure of independence has always been a necessary condition for black self-expression. Hence, the Black Church Independence Movement provided for blacks what the Declaration of Independence provided for the nation, namely, the condition for freedom and self-actualization. I also contend that even during slavery, slaves had some form of independent space. Otherwise, they would never have been able to place their unique mark on the Christian faith. Since the dates, place, and authorship of the so-called Negro spirituals are unknown, E. Franklin Frazier described this locus as the invisible institution, which is an apt portrayal of the underground rendezvous that characterized the slave religion. And that underground rendezvous was their independent space. Only in that independent space could the essential structures of black religion appear, chief among which has been the feature of black leadership over a black constituency. Rabiteau gives paramount importance to this notion of independence when he writes, "At the core of the slave's religion was a private space, represented by the cabin room, the overturned pot, the praying ground, and the hush harbor. This place the slave kept his own, for no matter how religious the master might be, the slave knew that the master's religion did not countenance prayers for his slave's freedom in the world. Only under conditions of racial separation have blacks been able to act in their own way, assess their own needs, shape their own agenda, determine their own priorities, develop their own styles of acting." Mays and Nicholson concluded several decades ago that the attributes of black church ownership and control constituted the nation's primary genius. The institution's primary genius. Only in that separate religious space that we call the black church has the race found adequate independence from the larger white hostile world to experience not only temporary relief from the impact of racism, but also to initiate, design, and implement methods of adjustment and of resistance to that hostile force. Only in such a space has the church been able to develop, enhance, and nurture the moral and social life of the race, which, as we've seen above, has always been viewed by blacks as a necessary but not a sufficient goal, rather a precondition for external relations with the larger society. Now, the experience of self-governance provided blacks with the opportunity to practice the basic rights of citizenship long before they became for them constitutionally guaranteed and politically enacted. Ironically, it became the destiny of the black preacher to emerge as one of the freest of all persons, black and white alike, because he embodied the condition, and here he is intentional, he embodied the condition of independence and freedom more than any other, intentional in the sense that the black preacher was at that time male. In his pulpit, he could condemn virtually any social evil in either the white or the black community without fearing the possibility of censorship. His condemnation of the established powers of the larger society for their role in aiding and abetting racial injustice, ensured him the jubilant praise of his congregation. Only some willful violation of the black community's trust ever threatened the black preacher's prestige and position. Accordingly, both he and his people exercised considerable power in relation to each other and together in relation to the white society. Now, the independence of the black churches has provided blacks with the necessary condition for the experience of freedom, which has had the following visible characteristics. That is, this freedom has been made visible by these characteristics. A, black men in positions of authority and power, shaping the values, perspectives, aspirations, and activities of the black masses, both in their separate racial existence and in their relationship with the white world. B, indigenous styles of worship, another visible form of this freedom. Indigenous styles of worship, of music, song, prayers, preaching intended to inspire the soul of the race to express its deepest needs and hopes and dreams. C, an internal church organizational structure that is reflective of its mission to exemplify the parenthood of God and the kinship of all peoples by proclaiming in word and deed the equality of the races. D, ecclesiastical programs expressing high priority for the educational, moral, and social development of the race, along with various forms of advocacy for racial justice and equality. Fifth, a black democratic constituency exhibiting great pride in its church tradition and exercising its vote with extreme care when electing its ruling officers, and especially bishops and presidents of conventions. Six, these are visible signs of this freedom. Six, a physical edifice symbolizing racial solidarity and religious meaning. And seventh, a widely known support system for all other black organizations and institutions, including many black businesses committed to serving the welfare of the race. All of those people know that they can get the support of the black church if they say that what they are doing is for the welfare of the race. Visible signs of freedom. That's what those are. Further, even a casual survey of the black community would reveal widespread public support for the potentialities and the benevolences of the black churches. And even when you have people criticizing the black churches, they do so with the presupposition that the black churches ought to be the way they think they should be, you see, and they're criticizing a departure from a norm. But the norm is appreciated and affirmed. Most importantly, the black churches view themselves and their distinctive characteristics as vivid contrasts to both the form and substance of the white churches. Vivid contrast. Consequently, they have been, that is, the churches have been, paradigmatic for the organized life of the black community because they actualize among themselves the condition of independence and the experience of freedom more accurately than any other organized effort. Now, let us look at the nature of power in the black churches with this as a condition. Independent black churches have always been in conflict with the larger white society. Another bottom line. A conflict that has often resulted in considerable ambivalence among blacks towards Christianity per se. On the one hand, blacks have loved and affirmed Jesus, while on the other hand, they have rejected white Christianity. The latter disposition, that is the rejection of white Christianity, has usually been radicalized in the ideologies of so-called black nationalist groups. During the first century of their enslavement, blacks refused to accept Christianity because they associated it wholly with the religion of their masters. They later became converts in large numbers only after they had had the opportunity to reform in practice the religion of their masters. Hence, the black churches were a necessary condition for the Christianization of the race. In other words, independence and Christian reform logically preceded the religious conversion of black Americans. That is, independence and Christian reform, that is, reform of white Christianity, that logically preceded black conversion to Christianity. Because blacks were all along rejecting Christianity, you see, as it was practiced by their masters and from whom they got it. And then they had to do something with that before they could give themselves in loyalty and devotion to it. And so what they did to it precedes the conversion. But the mission of the black church has always transcended its own constituency, that is a black constituency, by aiming at the reform of the larger white society. That is, causing the latter to practice racial justice as an expression of genuine Christian understanding. The mission of the black church, therefore, had both an internal and external dimension, in that it sought religious, moral, and political reform in both the black and the white communities, though not in the same respect. It had a mission to the black community and a mission to the white community. It is, however, ironic that the primary instruments of social reform employed by the black churches have been the religious and political ideals of their white oppressors. You see, their weapons, what were their weapons for this? Their weapons were the ideals, the religious and political ideals of their oppressors. That is, the biblical idea of the parenthood of God and the kinship of all people, one, and two, the constitutional idea that all people are created equal, endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. The religious idea had been used by blacks as a means of redeeming both the ecclesiastical and the civil religion of the nation, while the political idea has constituted the grounds of justification for their claims of racial justice. See, blacks have not gone about making claims for racial justice simply on religious grounds. They have done that when they've been dealing with, say, white churches and with the religious ideas of the nation. But also they could call upon the Constitution as a political justification for their claims for equal rights. Now, blacks have derived similar moral obligations from both ideas, the religious and the political ideas. Consequently, they have rightly viewed both as integrally related. That is, the political as derivative from the religious, only because the latter, the religious, is more universal. The church's use of the above instruments of social reform implied a commitment to wage the struggle for racial justice within the nation rather than from without. And therefore, black churches have been opposed to migration and or revolution. That is, officially. And here I'm talking about sort of that mainline tradition. Further, their belief in the biblical anthropology and its assumed affirmation by the Constitution implied devotion to nonviolent, legitimate means of advocacy. Neither violence nor colonization ever gained domicile in the black churches, even though a number of its members and a few disgruntled leaders from time to time opted for such strategies. But nowhere have the black churches officially ever taken a stand in favor of either colonization or violence. The existence of the black churches has always implied an indictment against the racial values of white America's religious, political, and social institutions. Since they, the black churches, have the ear and support of the black masses more than any other institution, the black churches have constituted a place of power both within the black community and as the black community's representative in the white society. Their position of institutional primacy in the black community has enabled them to be the locus of racial social solidarity, which in turn has comprised the basis of all cooperative activity that has been aimed at racial advance. In fact, their historical function of maintaining and enhancing racial solidarity gained for them the right to speak on behalf of the race whenever they wish. Consequently, they have been a major lobbying force of the black community for racial justice, which in their judgment has always meant racial equality. Racial justice has always meant racial equality. But further, their capacity to establish and maintain racial solidarity reveals both the religious and political basis of their power. Religiously, they have provided the community with that common set of fundamental ideas, rituals, symbols, and beliefs that unites the race in spite of its many differences. Politically, their power is understood in part as a persuasive capacity to achieve a moral effect both within the white and the black communities. Now, although their success in the white community has been disturbingly slow, you see, there's a mission here to change the white community and the black community. Now, what I'm saying is their success, the white community, has been disturbingly slow. The black churches have been very effective in creating a massive consensus in the black community concerning the rightness of their quest for racial equality, which alone constitutes the substance of their unity. Yet I'm not implying that their reform efforts in the larger society have been insignificant. I'm simply saying that as long as racism is there, they still haven't succeeded. On the contrary, their various forms of initiative and support have had both influence and impact on the body politic. And I give a number of examples of that and so forth. Let me start again with power. Power is both, and this is a definitional statement, power is both the capacity to produce an effect and to undergo an effect. Now, this is very crucial to the rest of what I'm saying about power. Power is the capacity to produce an effect and to undergo an effect. Now, this is not an original thought of mine. I am influenced by one Bernard Loomer in that definition. Like many in the society at large, and I'm going to set these in dialectical motion, to produce an effect and to undergo an effect. And what I'm going to say is that many people in the society at large think of power as the first to produce an effect. And black churches have thought of power as the second, in large part. That is to undergo an effect, insofar as they've thought of power very much. And maybe they haven't really thought about power that much in that way. I'm going to distinguish this as I go along. Like many in the society at large, the black churches have tended to understand power as the ability to produce an effect. Consequently, they have tended to view whites as having paramount power, evidence in their ability to have maintained the slave system for over three centuries and to have maintained racial subjugation for another 100 years. Correspondingly, they have viewed themselves as powerless because they have not been able to produce their desired effect on the white community in any full and complete way. That is to say, their inability to dominate whites, as the latter has done them, has led them to conclude that they, blacks, are powerless. And we've all heard us talk about us as being powerless. Since the attainment of that kind of power, that is the ability to manipulate, to shape, to control others, requires similar means of coercion. And since neither the black churches nor the black community at large has ever committed themselves fully to such methods of coercion, it is not difficult to see why they have failed to gain such power. Further, the structure of oppression is such that the oppressed are never able to possess the kind of power that their oppressors have, short of the successful use of violence deliberately employed in its pursuit. Although the black churches and other select organizations and persons have been able to wield some measure of control in the black community, they have never been able to do so in the white community. Sometimes, however, strategic coalitions with sympathetic whites have been effective in gradually producing limited effects on the body politic, effects, incidentally, that have issued in most of the significant milestones reached in the long pilgrimage toward racial justice. But unfortunately, the coalitions themselves have been fragile and tenuous because their internal relationships have tended to be dominated by this controlling type of power, which always works in opposition to mutuality and trust and community. That is, you can't hold together a coalition very long on that notion, with that notion of power operating. That such an orientation to power has also been a primary cause of the many and varied conflicts that have permeated the internal life of the black churches, as well as their relationship with one another. Now, Loomer calls this type of power unilateral power because it is interested only in its own purposes and tends always to reduce the other to a means to its own ends. Consequently, it is unable to exhibit concern for the other's total being. Hence, its activities inevitably contribute to the emotional estrangement from those to whom it is related. Consequently, it destroys love and is incapable of doing justice. Now, it is obvious that the historical conflict that has existed between the black churches and the larger white society has not resulted in any profound existential estrangement from whites by blacks. In spite of the persistent involvement of blacks in their advocacy for racial justice and their opposition to racism, as protagonists, they have rarely defined whites solely as the enemy. Although they have viewed the Ku Klux Klan as wholly hostile, blacks have refrained from viewing all white Americans similarly. Unlike a typical military battle where the enemy is considered unredeemable and hence is to be either avoided or destroyed, blacks adjusted themselves to the KKK by avoidance and rarely resorted to violence, even in self-defense. Martin Luther King rightly captured the spirit of the black community when he said repeatedly that nonviolent resistance is redemptive. While its active dimension fails to compromise evil, Its passive side manifests an alternative method of response that keeps the conditions of communication open rather than closed. The availability of such conditions implies the redeemability of the opponent. And the black churches have always believed that the white America is redeemable. But let us hasten to add that even short of violence, certain types of withdrawal from the situation can also imply a loss of confidence in the other's moral capacity for change. And various nationalist groups, when they've withdrawn, have made that judgment. There's no use. They are irredeemable. Their hostile environment evidences a form of power that is quite different from unilateral power. It has been called by many names in the tradition: soul force, moral suasion, moderation, nonviolence. But all the names are suggestive of an active openness towards the other. And that constitutes the distinctive quality of this type of power. It is what Bishop William J. Walls was attempting to describe when he said, "The story of the struggle of the black race to achieve full citizenship is the story of the AMEZ Church. Through the years, we tenaciously held back the bitterness and preached the gospel of nonviolence. The prayers, faith, tears, bloodshed, loss of life, organizing, mass meetings, negotiating, sit-ins, arrests, marches, fundraising, rallies, tortures, warfares, freedom rides, defeats, disappointments, harassments, threats, and victories bespeak the total involvement and desire to practice our love, love which worketh no ill to his neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfilling of the law." The quote is taken from the African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church, Reality of the Black Church. It was his book, which was published in 1974, page 533. Now, Loomer, whom I referred to, called this power relational power, and Paul Tillich called it the power of being. I choose to call it communal power because of its implicit drive for unity between the contending parties. Communal power is a force that recognizes the potentiality for community and strives unceasingly for its realization. While it is profoundly concerned about the welfare of the other, it is primarily concerned about maintaining the capacity for a continued viable relationship. You see, it's not simply concerned about the other. It certainly isn't just concerned about itself. You have self and other in relationship. It's concerned about the relationship between the two and the community, the potential community, and ongoingness of that. That's what communal power is. And the force that tries to seek that and to maintain it is what we're talking about. Preserving that capacity has been of paramount importance to the black churches in their struggle for racial justice. Their recognition of the nation's racism has been for them what a diagnosis is for a physician. This is a bit of an analogy here. In other words, they have been bent on curing the disease without destroying the patient. Further, their methods have been respectful of the larger organism, the larger organism being the laws and the values and functions. Moreover, they have not viewed the disease as terminal and hence have not withdrawn curative activities.
They know when they're applying a Band-Aid, but they know also that Band-Aids need to be applied. In effect, they have maintained their faith in the proposition that the problem would one day be resolved. It is the essence of communal power to sustain the potentiality for a communal relationship, regardless of the circumstances. Consequently, it never contemplates retaliation or revenge. Rather, it endlessly seeks more effective means for fostering communal experience. The black churches, as well as many other organizations in the black community, have held firmly to their love for America's potentiality for interracial community, and have refused to compromise that love by acts of vengeance. Further, it must be said that their love for America should not be construed to mean a mere love for whites, but rather a love for whites and blacks living harmoniously in community, which, in their view, constitutes what America should be. The many severe diatribes against America, frequently delivered by stalwart leaders of the black church and community, have been basic expressions of frustration, disgust, disappointment, disillusionment, and even hatred of America's actual racist policies. But their harsh criticisms have been rooted in a fundamental belief in America's potentiality for good, namely interracial justice. Viewed out of their context, that is, if you're going through minutes of conventions and conferences or looking at sermons or speeches of some of the leaders, such unwavering patriots as Frederick Douglass and Henry McNeil Turner, Reverend E. Ransom, and E.C. Morris, Adam Clayton Powell Jr., Martin Luther King Jr., and others, look, you can take things out of their context, paragraphs, sometimes whole pages, and they will be flaming denunciations that will make it appear that they are thoroughgoing revolutionaries. But instead, their rhetoric has served to express the wrath of the racist prophets, deeply loyal to the biblical view of humanity, which they were convinced had been affirmed by the nation's founding fathers. And in spite of the private lives of the founding fathers, in spite of the fact that the founding fathers themselves might have had slaves, black churches viewed the Constitution as even transcending them, that they intended, that it intends, the welfare of the races. Hence, their total identification with the goal they sought and their firm belief in the nation's potentiality to embody it caused them from time to time to pour forth eloquent criticism, not only as a means of expressing their own emotions, but also as a possible way of arousing the sensitivities of whites and to prick their consciences. In their struggle against racism, blacks have never understood themselves as a narrow self-interest group seeking their own satisfaction alone. Now that's what the unilateral idea of power is about. And this has produced a problem, as we have seen. On the contrary, they have sought to save the Republic from self-destruction and to redeem its democracy by destroying the malignant racism that threatens the well-being of the nation as a whole. Thus, the good that they have sought has been a new relationship between blacks and whites that would be characterized by equity. Now, I'm not trying to imply that the universe of black Americans has always expressed communal power. Some have expounded unilateral power, and in rhetoric and deed have either turned to violence and or colonization. But the black churches have never been a part of either scheme in any official or public way. Those church persons who adopted such an orientation either relinquished their association with the churches or they formed new religious associations. The notion of communal power enables us to understand better the many perplexing puzzlements one encounters in undertaking a critical analysis of the black American experience. Throughout this study, we have found ourselves troubled by the seeming absence of bitterness
of hostility, violence, and despair amongst blacks. In spite of conditions of slavery, lynching, terrorism, segregation, discrimination, and the social stamp of inferiority, the primary source materials, religious and secular, are replete with expressions of patriotic zeal, of interracial goodwill, respect for law and order, and devotion to America's potentiality for racial justice. Apart from a view of communal power, we must either conclude that black Americans, for the most part, accommodated themselves to racism and thereby contributed to their own degradation, or we are driven to do revisionist history by selectively thematizing those events, speeches, and personalities that manifest militant aggression, underground radicalism, revolutionary ideologies, and violent uprisings. Now, we must make it unequivocally clear that communal power is not the opposite of unilateral power. That would be, the opposite is mere passivity, or the total lack of any capacity whatsoever. Rather, communal power is both the capacity to produce an effect and to undergo an effect. Hence, it includes unilateral power, but is not identical with it. Its chief weakness lies in its tendency to neglect that aspect of itself and become so completely focused on the reconciliation of the other that it falls prey to the danger of making the other's feelings, understandings, and activities normative for itself, lest its own ends and interests get in the way of the other and hinder the relationship. You see, that's the chief weakness of communal power, that you can be so focused on the relationship and the reconciliation, and you'd be so concerned about the feelings and sensitivities of the other that you really cease focusing any primary interest on self-interest. And therefore, the things that you would get by virtue of self-interest, you can't get. Now, in doing so, that is, communal power can distort the relationship, both potentially and actually, by failing to make its own claims. Now, what I mean is, the relationship that we're seeking can be destroyed by blacks' failure in self-development, so to speak, in going after self-interest, because it looks like they don't really have anything themselves. You see, by ignoring that pole. And that pole is what has been ignored in the tradition. Blacks have, and black churches would set in motion various kinds of schemes and programs and projects, but they could never really put sufficient resources behind those projects in order to make them huge successes, because the real focus, the fundamental focus, was on something else. It was on the relationship between the races and thriving for that relationship. And so the pole of self-development has been sacrificed in the tradition. And I don't want to go on too much further. The development and the conflict with black power and black theology, which is what I develop from here on, takes place just at that point. The black churches became afraid of black power because black power looked like unilateral power. And much of its rhetoric and so forth seemed very much to be that. And black theology seemed to the black churches to be a justification for unilateral power. And so then, as that unilateral power was in conflict with communal power, so black power
became in conflict with the black churches, and black theology came in conflict with the theology of the black churches. Black power did to communal power what communal power did to unilateral power. You know, it sacrificed the other end of the pole. But yet both see what was lacking in each was fully present in the other. And there the argument then moves towards a complementarity to show how it is extremely important that both view each other as complementary. And a complementary relationship is always when something is lacking in one part of the relationship that is fulfilled by the other part. And so that which is lacking in development in the black church tradition is fulfilled in the black power and black theology tradition. And that which is lacking in the black power and the black theology tradition is fulfilled in that historical tradition of the black churches. And it takes another several pages for that to develop, but let me just cut it short and end it like that.
I think our schedule calls for a coffee break.
My assumption is that you might want to just stay in.